WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest has made an impact on American culture through his early experiments with LSD and as a spiritual leader. In the early 1960s, Richard Alpert was a Harvard professor of psychology conducting clinical research into the use of psychedelics. He and his colleague, Timothy Leary, were fired from Harvard in 1963. After continuing the experiments off campus, in 1967, Alpert went to India, where he met his guru and studied yoga and meditation. His spiritual teacher gave him a new name, Ram Dass. And when Ram Dass returned to the States, he was perceived as something of a guru himself. His 1971 book of advice, Be Here Now, became a bestseller. Now Ram Dass describes himself as pursuing service as a form of spiritual discipline. In 1978, he co-founded the group SEVA, a service organization that supports health and environmental organizations in developing countries and assists Native American groups in the U.S. When Richard Alpert became Ram Dass, his father mocked the change, and there was an enormous rift between the hippie hero's son and the father who had served as president of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad. Ram Dass's father died last year at the age of 90, and in the last years of his life, Ram Dass lived with his father and cared for him when Ram Dass wasn't on the road. I asked what was responsible for the change in their relationship.
Well, both of us changed. As he got older, he mellowed, he deepened, he quieted. His personality changed a lot. And I also saw that honoring him, honoring my family, was part of my route to freedom. That we had a concept of freedom in the 60s that pushed away family. We got so obsessed with independence and individualism that we lost something of the richness that comes from family. Not only don't you have built-in babysitters, but you just don't have a built-in emotional support system. And when I came back to take care of Dad and took care of my stepmother through her death and all that, I felt tremendously enriched by it. I felt that these were gifts that were given to me. And that when I turned my heart around and saw and honored the fact, there was a point in my life where I realized that I had to honor my incarnation, that it wasn't my enemy, it was my vehicle, it was my curriculum, if you will. And then he became part of my curriculum. And then getting straight with him became part of the way I got free, because as long as you push something away, it's got you.
We're talking about pushing back your father. It strikes me in your own way you pushed back your own life, even by changing your name and by changing your whole public identity.
Exactly. In fact, those first years were basically a renunciate path of renouncing my humanity, renouncing my sexual desires, renouncing my social, my family, my nation-state identity, all of those identities. And there was a certain point where I realized that I could get high that way, but if I wanted to be free, free meant not turning away from anything. It meant being free in the midst of it all.
What did you most want to renounce about yourself, your past, you know, your identity?
I think I wanted to renounce my lack of compassion for the have-nots that came out of my middle-class fears. I think I feel, you know, people feel impoverished from their childhood for a lot of reasons. I feel impoverished from my childhood because I didn't grow up in a family that had great social concerns. I mean, we were charitable, but we weren't really caring in that way, you know?
When you first returned to the States as Baba Ram Dass after you had studied with your spiritual teacher in India, and you came here with a new name and with robes and a long beard,
none of which I have now, by the way.
Yeah, I should mention that.
For those of you who don't see me.
That's right. You're wearing civilian clothes, a trimmed mustache. Why did you don the clothes and the beard that's kind of like the prototypical guru look?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when you're new to something and you're trying to change the way you are in a social structure, if you have symbols that lead people to treat you differently, it helps. And when I walk down the street with beard and beads and barefoot and this long dress like a pharaoh, it was hard for people to treat me the way they would treat another person. And it kind of left an open space for me to adopt a new identity. It was a functional, costume. It was like a chameleon type thing.
You told us a couple of the benefits of wearing, you know, the kind of guru garb. What were some of the problems that it brought? Did it bring any?
Well, the problem is the same problem that I have with the name Ram Dass now, is that it turns off a lot of people that could be people with whom I could share our shared awareness or awakening or our social concerns or our ecological concerns, that I'm seen as a cult person because of the label or the dress or the things like that. And I think it alienated people unnecessarily. I think that was part of it. I think it also made people put you into a category immediately, which then they had a set of responses or reactions to your category. And I think being more ambiguous is more interesting in terms of giving people a chance to explore new places in their own heads.
You say that Ram Dass, for some people, puts you into a certain category. Didn't you at one point change your name back to Richard Alpert?
I tried, but it didn't seem to work. I was so used to being Ram Dass in people's minds that my publisher didn't want to do it. They said it wouldn't sell books. And the other part of it was that Ram Dass is such a beautiful name, and it means servant of God. And now, because I did How Can I Help a few years ago with Paul Gorman, a service book, which is used by nurses and doctors. I've mainstreamed in that way. And then once you mainstream, people overlook the name. It's just kind of irrelevant to them. So I'm a good guy now, so it doesn't matter. When you're a bad guy, it was another reason to be bad.
You did drop the Baba.
Yeah.
What does Baba mean, and why did you drop it?
It means kind of grandfather, elder. It's a term of respect. But all those things, like I've also dropped doctor because I'm a PhD. But all those labels, it seems to me, I just don't feel I need any labels. Why not just be right here?
Ram Dass is my guest, if you're just joining us. Can we go back a bunch of years?
Like
Let's go back to the early 60s when you were Richard Alpert and you were a professor of psychology at Harvard University and were one of the first people, and one of the very first East Coast people, to start experimenting with LSD. Mm-hmm. What use were you putting it to in your official capacity in the university?
Well, I'm a research psychologist, and that's a study of the mind, psyche, logos. And these chemicals are incredible in overriding habitual ways of seeing the universe and allowing a fresh way of perceiving. And they connected me to levels of my awareness that my Western psychological framework didn't cover. And so just as a student of the mind, I started out with that exploration. In the process of my early experience, I had what later I could acknowledge as spiritual experiences, which for a Western social scientist, spiritual stuff was seen as, like an anthropologist would see or a Freudian would see it, as sublimated something or other, or, you know, the creation of the human mind. But I really tuned into a larger context in which I exist other than my material, sensual thinking context.
So you started using LSD as part of your academic research, but once you started actually taking LSD yourself, that academic research no longer seemed relevant?
Well, I'll tell you, it was because we did studies to show, and I think that it's painful to me that in our zeal to say no to drugs, we have not differentiated between the tryptamines, for example, the psychedelics, which have potential for social change, for use. Like, we worked with prisoners in prisons where the recidivism rate is so bad. Working in marriages, working with dying people to help them extricate themselves from identification with being that which dies. There were tremendous potential uses, all of which the research has been wiped out by the society's fear of drugs other than for liquor and, you know, things like that. But so our research continued to, we started in a naturalistic way because those kind of chemicals were seen in our society as psychotomimetics. That is, they were used by psychiatrists to parallel schizophrenia. And while in other cultures they were used for religious and oracular processes. And we said, instead of laying a trip on them, let's just give them to people and get reports back, and let's see how they use them and build a new kind of context for them. And then we began to see how set and setting were so important, that a person could have them and have a religious experience. They could use them to escape. They could use them for creative work. They could use them for therapeutic change.
You and Timothy Leary at Harvard started using LSD, and then Ken Kesey on the West Coast started using it, I think in very different ways, in a different setting. Did you have any conflicts with Kesey about what LSD should mean in the society, how it should be used?
Well, we were somewhere in the middle, because there were, I mean, we had Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts and all these people. There was a community of us that were researching. And in a way, we were saying, let's keep it reasonably quiet so we can research, because it's very controversial and it's going to upset the culture. At the same moment, we were opening the door at Harvard with students and so on. So we were partly responsible. Ken blew it apart in a way with the acid test, because he made it a street scene. And that frightened the society so much, it forced the laws, it forced legislation probably a couple of years before it would have happened. And maybe the research could have gotten more entrenched had there been a little more space.
So you still regret that that research wasn't given a chance?
Yeah, I regret it even now. I think it would be wonderful. Not us, but I mean, there are a lot of other people that could do research now.
Have you found that it's become more difficult to talk about psychedelic drugs, either in terms of the present or in terms of the research that you did in the past, in the climate today surrounding drugs, where the big fear is really around addictive drugs like crack and cocaine. And heroin.
I think it is. It's certainly difficult if I talk in the mass media. There's a lot of reaction. I usually, when I have the opportunity, I really go into the issues of crack and cocaine and show the way in which they are symptoms of a malaise in our society, that in the crack issue is the lack of opportunities, economic opportunities in inner city life. And in the cocaine in the middle class, it's that they've lived out the myths where they thought they would be happy if they won, and then they don't feel that sense of contentment. And part of the myth is more will be better, so they go for the greed quality of more experience. And I think that every technological advance is open to misuse, as we have certainly learned. I mean, and psychedelics is no exception.
You were just correcting me while our microphones were off that you are not exactly the head of the SABA Foundation.
I'm just another member of the board. We have a rotating chairmanship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, eventually you went to India, studied with a teacher who became your spiritual teacher. Can you tell us something about him and about the kind of spiritual path you took with him?
Well, meeting him was the power of that initially was that everything that I took LSD to touch in my being, I realized he was. In fact, he actually took 900 micrograms of LSD and nothing happened to him, because it's like if you're in Detroit, you don't have to take a bus to Detroit. I mean, he was that quality. He had integrated it. So it showed me the potential that a human being, he showed me what a human being could be in terms of freedom from a fixed model of himself and a quality of love that was, I experienced as unconditional, because he was resting in a place in himself where he didn't want anything from me. He didn't want my money. He didn't want anything. He didn't want my love. He didn't want anything from me. He didn't even want me to change. He didn't want anything. And I had never been in the presence of somebody who didn't want something from me. I mean, that was a big thing for me. That opened my heart a great deal. And he died in 1973, and I would say he is the most real, I don't know how to say it, entity in my consciousness still now. That once you have a friend like that who has that quality of compassion and has that quality of emptiness and that quality of the giggle, the cosmic giggle, you just carry that with you. And that's the way in which he continues to influence my life.
There have been so many, both American and foreign spiritual teachers who have been responsible for terrible corruption and for many deaths.
Yeah.
In the United States, what do you think has gone wrong there? And I'm sure it's something you've thought about because it's the kind of thing that makes people suspicious in general of spiritual leaders.
I don't blame them. I think that Easterners that have come to the West are very vulnerable to the culture. For example, in the East, if you're a Hindu sadhu, the women and men are very segregated in the temple scene. Here, they're not. Here, women embrace you. You're not used to that if you're living in the East. You're very vulnerable. You haven't built protective devices for handling that or for learning how to socialize that or deal with it. And I think many of them just fell by the wayside. They just weren't used to the onslaught of desire provocation that our advertising, that our lifestyle is about. And I think that there is a... we in the West are so enamored of power, and a lot of yogis develop what are called siddhis or powers in the East. And they come here and that power starts to be a card of entree to all kinds. They can read minds, they can do stuff, and then they start to use the power. And one of the rules of yoga is when you develop the powers, don't use them. Let them happen through you sometimes, but don't you use them because they will corrupt you. And I think that's where a lot of them fell, in the corruption of their intention to use their power, even when they thought they were doing it for good, by the way.
Have you had your defenses up, so to speak, because there's been, you know, the chance of a cult of personality developing around you, whether you intended it or not?
I think my guru protected me a lot. He said, Ram Dass, no ashrams, no monasteries. And what I've learned is I have no students, I have no disciples, I have no place people come to. I'm a wandering, you know, person. I just come, I feel I'm a networker. My image of myself, which I tell the audiences all the time, is I am a mouthpiece for a process a lot of us are going through. And my job is to say it well. And that's it. I'm a networking agent. I am not an enlightened being. I am not a guru. And in that way, then if they say, isn't he humble, and he is, and they project it, that's their projections, then what I have to learn to live with is not to buy other people's projections. And that's a good art for all of us to learn, how to see a projection coming at you of, oh, how great you are, or, oh, you're an irresponsible fool because you used drugs one time. And let the other people's minds' projections go through you sort of like Chinese food, you know, instead of grabbing at you and holding on.
I want to talk with you a little bit about sexuality because I know that that's been an important issue throughout the different stages of your life. When you first started becoming very spiritually involved, you became celibate for a while. What was your reasons for choosing celibacy?
I think that the model of celibacy is very strong in the East, and it's based on the idea that there are certain desire systems in the human animal that are so strong that it's very hard to extricate your awareness from an identification with those desire systems. So the best thing to do is to keep away from them, to segregate yourself from them, and to deny them, okay? Then I realized that in the West, that leads to what I call the horny celibate syndrome, okay? And that led me to the next stage, realizing I have to have commerce with that. I have to find peace. I have to be able to acknowledge the desires without getting lost in an identification with them. And that opened me to another chapter of my life, okay? And I'm bisexual, and that has led me, in a way, that has been extraordinary because since my early homosexuality segregated me from the society, because when I was experiencing that in my early years, you were closeted for it. That built a lot of compassion into me for what minority group and what segregation persecution is about. It has also made me very, very open to the AIDS issue, not in a personal sense, but in the sense of being empathetic with the nature of the sexual desires that led to, for the gay community, to the predicament they find themselves in.
You've been working a lot with people who have AIDS.
And I also train buddies, and I've been helping set up hospices for residential hospices for AIDS people to die in.
I want to ask you a question about your father who we were talking about earlier. He died in the past year. You had been living with him when you weren't on the road and helping to take care of him. I don't know how he was when he died, but at one point in his life he was a wealthy man. Was there an inheritance, and how did you decide to use it?
My guru said to me early on, he said, "Your father has money?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Are you going to leave it to you?" I said, "Well, he's going to leave me a portion of it." He said, "You're not to accept your inheritance." I said, "Boy, that's interesting. I mean, to tell that to a Jewish boy is something, you know." I couldn't tell my father because he had raised it, you know, earned it for his kids. And he trusted me so much, he made me the executor and all of that. But what I've done is I divided what went to my brothers and my nieces and nephew, and then the rest of it I've given away.
So you never told him that you weren't going to personally accept it?
No, I felt that that would be hurting him.
So you thought it was okay to not tell him the complete truth about this?
He never asked me.
Okay.
He just assumed. But there was some subtle thing that happened between us, because the minute my guru said that, that money no longer was mine. And in some deep psychological way, that changed my relationship to my father. After that, I wanted him to spend his money. I wanted him to, you know, there was no longer my money that he was using. And I helped him get married. I gave away the bride in his second marriage. I was close friends with him. I helped them enjoy themselves as much as I could. And he sensed that. He sensed that I didn't want something from him. And I think that's why he trusted me to give me power of attorney, to make me executor, you know, as I'm not a lawyer. And so.
Not wanting something from you. That's what you said you felt towards your teacher, that he didn't want anything from
you.
Exactly. That's very important to you.
It's quite an art, isn't it? Yeah. It's quite an art.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure, Terry.
Ram Dass is co-founder of the Seva Foundation. He's currently on a national lecture tour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.